Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Gunter Guns for Glory in Tasty Tokyo Teaser. Roland revels as Nissan goes native. Cassidy caps Big Cat Century with classy comeback. And Porsche in the pink as Formula E blossoms. Hello, it's the Race Formula E podcast from the first ever Tokyo Grand Prix, recorded in situ, which I think is a first. I'm your host, Andrew Vandenberg, and joining me as ever, having suckered up the local culture, is our correspondent Sam Smith. Sam, we're actually sitting in Tokyo recording this, a race that was mooted before I even joined Formula E 11 years ago. They finally made it happen. What did you make of it all?
Yeah, we're in the lobby of the hotel, some blurry-eyed Formula E people after a night of either drowning their sorrows or celebrating results yesterday. Inaugural Tokyo at Ypres, it was a holy grail race for Formula E. I think in terms of what it delivered, a decent race, a good racetrack. I thought it was a gnarly old school racetrack, and it wasn't perfect. It will be smoothed out, or there could be a different iteration of it when we come back next year. But speaking to the powers that be at Formula E, this is a long-term deal, and they've put some good routes in this weekend. So yeah, I think it will become a mainstay of the championship.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I said they've always wanted to do. The way they set it up, you did make it to the podium. It's in the fan village. Obviously, you could get in there for free, or if you'd been at the sort of net zero summit was going on, you got entry to it. So there were probably a good 3,000 or 4,000 people in there for the podium. So it was a really nice vibe.
Yeah, good atmosphere. I think that they need more people in there. You know, it's literally called the big site, so they should be able to get something in there.
It's huge, that venue, isn't it?
Yeah, it sort of dwarfs the XL. I mean, there is an XL vibe to it. It's by the Tokyo sort of bay estuary area. When it's grey and rainy, it's as somebody said to me in the paddock, it should remain nameless, looks a bit like Milford Haven. But actually, when the sun shone on race day, it had a really nice atmosphere and a good, I think a sort of it was slightly sort of community feel to it. There was a, you know, everybody seemed to be there who was enthusiastic, seemed to sort of want for the greater good of Formula E, and they really got engaged with what Formula E is trying to do. And then, as you mentioned, the other stuff with the zero emissions festival that they had, Prime Minister of Japan was there. So, you know, they had a really good big event feel to it, but it needs to expand a bit, I think, in the coming years, which there are plans to do that, of course.
Yeah, I think there were 8,500 grandstand seats, but that was very much imposed by the city itself rather than Formula E. I think they could have sold at least double that.
Yeah, I think they expanded it a bit. I think it was more like the sort of 12,000 by the end of it. But yeah, there are plans for expansion. What you got to remember about Tokyo is, in terms of legislation and bureaucracy, it's an absolute, well, from the perspective of putting anything on, a nightmare to deal with. It's taken, as you said, a decade to do. They've done the hard work, and they've done the groundwork to get this event on, and they've got a foothold now, so they've now got to really make it into something better. I was speaking to a couple of team bosses last night, and the one thing that would be mega at this venue is a night race, full on, yeah, neon, Blade Runner style thing with the backdrop of those big skyscrapers and the Tokyo Tower would look absolutely fantastic. So if they can get that together, it's not cheap to do that, but if they can get a deal somehow to make that happen, I think it'll capture the imagination of all the Tokyo Drift kids that are out there.
Also, of course, it puts you in a much better time zone for a European TV audience. So that's actually a very nice idea. I hope they can make that happen. Well, let's talk about the race itself. A first win of the season for MSG Maserati and Max Günther. How did he do it?
Well, very cutely. I mean, I don't think he had ultimately the quickest package out there. I think over one lap he was with Roland, with the Nissan. But I think where the victory came from was a really cute pivot in the strategy, because he got a bad start. Mortara got him off the line. He was stuck behind Mortara, managed to get him at T16, got into the draft of Roland. And the draft is the key thing here. Yeah. These Gen 3 cars, when you're behind in the slipstream, you are not only conserving energy, you know, your energy targets become a whole lot easier, and you put you in a great position for that sort of breakaway sprint towards the end of the race. And that's exactly what he did. You know, when you look at the move that he did exiting turn 9 on Roland, it looked like he just blasted past and
right, Ollie, Roland let him through.
Well, kind of. So Max explained it to me that Roland was mega through turn 9, which was the long sweeping right-hander, one of the best corners on the track, actually, really spectacular. And what he noticed was that Ollie was absolutely nailed there, so there's no way past on the immediate exit of that. But what he knew was that where Ollie was lifting and coasting into 10 a little bit, and exploited that. So he sort of stalked him before, made a bit of a surprise move, quite an aggressive move. Obviously, he spent a bit of energy and then had to get the energy targets back. But Maserati really had to sort of switch their strategy, because immediately when they got stuck behind Mortara, they knew that they had to spend a bit more energy. So that there's a bit of a yin and yang with what they were going to do with their energy targets from that point on. And then he had to defend in the last two laps. And, you know, defending against Ollie Roland on a gnarly street track, that needs maximum concentration. So from Max's point of view, but I think more the team's point of view on the way that they were able to switch their strategy from, you know, maybe a slightly more conservative approach in the first part of the race to actually then going on the attack, making the move on Mortara in turn 10, I think it was, and then getting Ollie after sort of stalking him a bit and getting the energy targets right. I thought it was a well-judged victory in a car which probably wasn't quite as quick, ultimately, as the Nissan, but they exploited it and they got through.
So on the flip side of that, was it an error by Roland? He'd been absolutely mega in qualifying, fantastic pole lap, to lead for so long? Because it became clear that he was a percent or two down on energy as a result of creating that hole in the air for everyone to follow behind.
Yeah, well, that's the crux of the matter. I mean, being at the front was not where you want. I think it was a bit of a surprise how much more of an energy-saving race it was. You know, I think people thought it was going to be an out-and-out sprint, but there was a bit more with the... They got a slashing of the usable energy to 32 kilowatts, which is sort of London XL-esque. And what that means is that you obviously have just got essentially less energy to get to the end of the race, and you've got to manage it a bit more critically. There was a safety car. I think, obviously, it didn't help Roland that the safety car came out, sort of helped Günther a little bit more. But all in all, I think to call it an error on Ollie's part, track position, it's that whole sort of dichotomy of, you know, where do you get track position? Do you want to lead the race for, you know, 90% of the race and be susceptible to attack from behind and, you know, somebody who's got a bit of a better energy total? So I think Ollie thought that he would be able to make a similar move back on Max, because he was, you know, he was feathering the throttle a bit more in the last knock-ins of the race, but ultimately they judged it just right. I mean, they got to the end. He was able to defend, and in combination with the fact that it was really tough to get by on that track, really narrow,
yeah,
I think it just suited getting track position from Maserati's point of view.
Overall, though, not a bad result for Nissan in their home race. I mean, it certainly cheered the crowds when he put it on pole. And, of course, the weekend where they announced, became the first manufacturer to commit to the Gen 4 rules as well.
Yeah, a huge weekend for Nissan. Major supporters, whole grandstand full of flag-waving Nissan fans. Lots of execs here. You know, we saw a lot of them in the garage, and a lot of suits in town, so they had to be impressed. I think a pole and a second position, if you'd have offered that to them before the start of the race, they'd have sort of bitten your hand off. Third consecutive podium for Ollie Rowland, right in the title fight now, third in the point standings, and just 9 points off Pascal Wehrlein at the top of the championship. So ultra strong start for Oliver Rowland. I remember speaking to him in Derir actually, and he sort of pretty strongly suggested that he's going to be a force this year. Just feels comfortable in a team that he knows.
So 3 straight podium finishes there.
Yeah, exactly. So he is the sort of, he's not a dark horse, but he's somebody that you didn't really envisage being in this position after 5 rounds of the championship. So I think it's bittersweet because they're in such a good position. They led for such a long time. I think they not expected a victory, but it looked for big swathes of that race that they were the overwhelming favourite. But they'll definitely take that.
You mentioned earlier on that this was very much an old school Formula E track, and we saw it was a little bit more arms and elbows than some of the more flowing road courses that Formula E tends to go on to now, and that allowed a few people to shine who normally don't. And I'm thinking in particular Edo Mortara and Sergio Sete Câmara, both of whom certainly in qualifying delivered amazing results, and Mortara almost held on to it in the race before getting disqualified in slightly bizarre circumstances that I don't think either of us have quite got our head around yet.
Ultimately, it was a team error from Mahindra Racing that got Mortara disqualified. Sadly, they went over the 2 total energy available that can be used, which is 32 kilowatt hours, and Mortara was disqualified from the race. It would have been an error over the software management of the regulatory use of that energy. So just a devastating blow, really, after all that hard work that was done by Edo and the team. They certainly deserved much more than they got from their weekend's endeavours. But yeah, ultimately it was a slam dunk offence, breached Article 7.5 of the technical regulations, and it was all over. So yeah, a sad end, but it's not unknown for that to happen. It has happened before, and the way it transpired, I think, from Edo was a sort of a ramp down of the energy in the closing stages of that race, and it did for him sadly in the end.
Really unfortunate, you know. It means that he's come away with nothing, where for an issue that wasn't, probably didn't give him any additional performance, may have been an extra tenth of a second on that final lap or something, but very, very unfortunate for him.
Yeah, it was. They deserve some points. They deserve some something to celebrate. Mahindra, they've had some lot of frustration this year. There's been a lot of positivity around the team. I mean, it is a much more gelled together, much happier.
Well, it's way
team.
More competitive than last year.
Yeah, but just the feeling, the morale in the team. I think Fred Bertrand's done a decent job to get that back, because it must have been very hard to maintain last year when there was just no, zero results, you know, tangible results coming. And yes, they've got no points. They're the only team now that don't have any points on the board, but they will get points this season.
Yeah.
And if the race is like this, you know, they can get top sixes, but beyond that, it's going to take, you know, it's going to take a lot of attrition, or it's going to take circumstances with other teams and drivers for them to get anything better than that. But yeah, you had to feel for them, because Mortara certainly deserved to come home with some points at the weekend.
So this was the 100th race for Jaguar Racing in Formula E, but not one that's necessarily going to be have a particularly large chapter written about it when the book is closed on this. Although, having been disqualified from qualifying and starting 18th, Cassidy did a really, really solid job on a track, as you said, difficult to overtake on, to bring back some solid points, which keeps him firmly in the title hunt. But for Mitch Evans, is it too early to say that his championship fight is over now? He's a long way back, given how many races we're in.
Yeah, way too early. You know, we've got 11 rounds left, and we've got a whole bunch of double headers. And Mitch has proved in the past that he can take a clean sweep. He's done that before in Rome. He currently sits 6th in the championship, 39 points. So yeah, you know, he's 24 points behind, which is less than a victory in any given round. So no, Mitch had a frustrating weekend, got pinged in qualifying for blocking. He was one of 3 or 4 drivers that got done for that, went back in the grid, yeah, got through to the duels, did a decent job, glanced the wall in the qualifying duels in his quarter final, and then in the race he lost some positions at the start, and then he went for a move on Sete Câmara. Clobbered Frines, did his wing.
It was a bit clumsy, wasn't it?
It was a bit clumsy, but this is the track that any you know, you make a risk and you dive down the inside of somebody, just the space and the room and just getting it right is, you know, you are relying on other drivers. And, you know, but this was a slam dunk Mitch mistake. Just put him out of contention, 0 points. Nick Cassidy, I thought one of the drives of the race, actually, coming from 18th to get 4 points for 8th position. I think, you know, when you look at where he is in the points, he's second, just 2 points behind Wöhrlein now. Had a poor race in Sao Paulo, learnt a lot from some issues they had in qualifying, did well in qualifying, then got the penalty, put him on the back foot. And I think, you know, when he was sat in 18th on the grid, way back somewhere, you know, near Kyoto, starting that event, I don't think he'd have thought he'd be coming home with anything at his kind of home race, let's call it, after living in Japan for and racing in Japan for so many years. So I think he
really no one ever mentioned it over the course of the weekend.
Yeah, everyone was hitting Nick up for recommendations for sashimi places and the best coffee shops in town, including us. So I think he will be pretty happy with what was achieved there, because he was quick, but just couldn't show it because he got stuck right down in the mire.
So we haven't mentioned the final podium place finisher. It was Jake Dennis, and a very solid weekend for him and all of the Porsche entries.
Yeah, they did a decent job, actually. You know, consistency has been difficult to find for Andretti and for Jake. And he told me on Thursday that was born out of some changes they made, software package that they had for this season, and it was proving difficult for him to get a feel of the car that he got last year. You know, one thing he had last year was consistency, and he didn't have it this year so far. But what he showed in Tokyo was that even though he qualified, where did he qualify? He did make it through to the duels, didn't he? But started the race,
frantic looking at
the race in fifth, but he had Moltar and Sete camera in front of him. He obviously had to clear Sete, which he did very quickly, made a good start, built a good race, and was in the mix with Wöhrlein and Da Costa, and had pretty much every race now had some feisty interaction with Pascal Wöhrlein.
That seems to be the law, doesn't it?
And a bit of, you know, there's a bit of radio banter, let's call it. I was wondering if there's a setting now on his radio where he just plays a recorded message from previous races of his, you know, slight frustration of racing Wöhrlein. But yeah, came through from third, got Da Costa at the end when Da Costa made a move on Ollie Rowland that didn't quite stick, and he slipped through. So nice racing from Jake. Yeah, very happy with third, I think, on this occasion, especially when you've got two, although we say they're not in championship contention, Maserati, Gunter and Rowland with Nissan. It could be one of those seasons where there are interlopers in the championship.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't rule Rowland out, as we discussed earlier on. I think Gunter will do well to sustain that level of performance. But, I mean, on the basis of what we saw yesterday, why not? But you just don't see MSG Maserati being at quite that same level of consistency, I think.
Well, we pretty much just ostracised them from anything in terms of winning or being on podiums in our season preview.
Yeah.
And that was based on the fact that in Valencia, they turned up in Valencia in a bit of a, you know, bit of a state. They'd had a lot of off-season manoeuvrings, let's say, in the team. The long-term future of the team was and possibly is still in doubt from the MSG element, although I'm told that is now a bit more secure than it was.
Okay.
And maybe actually that has just helped sort of get a bit more cohesiveness within the team. But actually, when you look back and you look at Mexico and the fact that Gunter got some points in Mexico and then had a really great Diria, I think, again, got points. I think they, through the new, let's call it the new technical management at the top end with Cyril Blay, who gets more and more impressive of every race in terms of what he's doing and moulding that team and getting that ethic within that team. And you've got somebody like Gunter, who when he doesn't make the odd mistake is always at the sharp end or close to it. They've got a great package. Yeah, whether it's to be sustained throughout the season, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think what we saw in Tokyo yesterday, you know, he can win more races this year.
And what happened with teammate Norman Nato, who was doing the okie cokie with the results at the end? And in and out, and ultimately in.
Yeah.
Seventh.
This was confusing. So he had an incident with Robin Freins, took his attack mode, slipped by Robin Freins, and then going into, turn 8? Turn 9, anyway. there was contact between the two of them.
To me, it looked like an absolutely classic racing incident. I was very surprised that he got pinged for it.
Yeah, two into one, a tight, narrow part of that circuit. I did speak to Robin afterwards.
Well, he was always going to be angry about it, of course.
He was. He thought he got sort of manhandled out of the way. I think it was just inevitable there was going to be some contact there with Norman making that move. And it was the same corner that Evans made some contact with Sete Câmara, so just before turn nine. Yeah, I mean... Probably a racing incident. Probably a bit rude from Norman, but in the overall scheme of the circuit and the way the layout was, I think there can be some excuse for a bit of contact there. He was given a 5-second penalty towards the end of the race, which moved him outside of the points. Then about an hour after the race, I saw Roger Griffiths, who explained that they had lodged a petition of appeal. And they had given some onboard footage had been found from Norman Natto's perspective that showed that he made the manoeuvre and stayed on the racing line, to quote the actual bulletin, and he was reinstated into the points. Which, so two ways of looking at it, it possibly could be the right decision, and with the new evidence found, it could be argued that. You know, but if you actually think about other teams who are affected by the results, I mean, Sascha Fenestra has lost a point through the original decision. It's that whole question of stewards making a decision and then going back an hour later after race. We're used to it in football, aren't we? With
VAR. Yeah. Oh God. Don't talk about that.
But you know, that takes can take a few minutes. Yeah. But this took an hour or so after the podium.
I'm very much of the opinion that when the fans leave, they should know what the result is. They should not have to be trying to look up to find what the final finishing positions were. I think it's one of the more alienating aspects of motorsport. Fine them heavily if needs be, but don't change the result.
No. I think that probably needs to be looked at. I mean, the technology exists to make pretty quick decisions. The stewards have a driver advisor who on this occasion was Alexander Sims. A little bit of irony there with Alexander being an ex-Andretti guy. But, you know, we are presuming here, we don't know for sure, but the presumption being that Alexander was fundamental to that process as the driver's eye. And maybe there was just a change of opinion on seeing extra footage.
Look, I mean, I'm all for new evidence being brought to light and the right decision being made, but I don't know. I go back to the original point of the fans leaving, knowing what the result was, rather than... I mean, how many people who were there are going to be looking up the result afterwards? They're not, are they? They're going to think what they saw going across the line was the result they saw.
I just think from the team's perspective, and not just the teams involved, Andretti and Envision, you know, but other teams who were expecting bigger points to then do their press releases, call their board members up,
correct,
tell them, and then actually they've got to make another call and say, actually, no, we were in a different position. But
yeah. There we go.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at armorall.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
You mentioned there Antonio Felix da Costa almost on the podium, but like I say, the move he tried to make for second ultimately ended up dropping him back to fourth, but easily his strongest performance of the season in a very striking pink-coloured Porsche. Everyone was really getting into the cherry blossom thing here, but none quite as much as Porsche we were.
It's a bit lurid, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think that kind of cherry blossom had some E-numbers in it, hadn't it? Too many chemicals. I mean... Yeah, pretty vibrant look, new look for Porsche.
That's not permanent though, right? It was just a one-off.
Oh, let's hope not.
Yeah.
No, it's just a one-off. But, you know, the last time they did a one-off was in Mexico. They had that quite nice lilac-looking car in Verline 1. Didn't happen this time. They had a decent race. There's a bit of, again, a bit of orchestration between Da Costa and Verlaine. Da Costa seemed to have the upper hand on Pascal this time around. Second pretty solid performance from Antonio, and he was genuinely in the hunt for second place. You know, mentioned that move on Roland, and he was sniffing a runners-up position, and who knows, maybe even a crack at Gunther in the last stages. He was in good shape. Did a really nice race. Did Antonio ultimately got fourth place, strongest performance of the season. Coming up, bit of a live update of the Andretti press officer tripping up in the lobby. He's recovered. I don't think he's done his nose.
Black flag on that.
If you're listening, we've saw that. I think Da Costa had a strong performance in Sao Paulo, got that confidence level back in what he's able to achieve. Really another strong result here. But here's the thing, VDB, off track.
Yes.
An interesting development, which we've reported on the-race.com on Antonio Felix Da Costa.
So go on. What's happening? Because ironically, given this after his best showing of the season, appears that he's on some thin ice, shaky ground. How firm are we going here?
It seems to be the case. I mean, this is, you know, we are. He's had his difficulties. Riyadh was
awful. I mean, probably a career low for him.
It really was. We have discovered that Porsche had a test at the Almería track in Spain earlier in March, and they tested a number of their junior drivers who they will be using at the Berlin test, which is Thomas Preining and Matt Campbell. They also had another driver there, Nico Müller, tested for Porsche.
Interesting.
Which is intriguing, and I was told by Porsche that this was a test focusing on Season 11. So Season 11 would suggest that if they're using another driver from a rival team, that they are evaluating a change in their lineup.
Yeah.
And we know that Pascal Wehrlein is a long-term member of that team. So it would suggest, speculatively, that they are possibly looking to replace Antonio Felix Da Costa at the team next season. So a bit of a bombshell, to say the least, but a test for Nico Müller for Porsche was the talk of some sections of the paddock last weekend.
Fascinating stuff. Well, let's see how that one plays out. But I think, you know, it was a good drive from him this weekend. And, you know, we know what he's capable of. Former champion, of course, multiple race winner. But let's see. I'm sure he wouldn't struggle to find a drive elsewhere on the grid if necessary. One team who were, frankly, nowhere, DS Penske. So while one Stellantis car was winning the race, Jean-Éric Vergne and Stoffel Vandoorne, anonymous. I mean, not even within a sniff of the points. What's going on there?
Well, not a lot. They just haven't got the pace. They haven't got the pace. They've not got the setup. They're not able to make any headway after difficult qualifying sessions. Formula E this season, if you are 0.2 off in qualifying and you are outside of the top six in your qualifying group and you're starting mid-grid, you are not going to make the progress that we saw on some occasions last season. Yes, you know, there are anomalies with Cassidy, who is in a quick car and who is able to make the progress. But if you haven't got the pace during any given race, you are just going to be, at best, bogged down in the upper reaches of the midfield,
yeah,
the periphery of the points. That's exactly what happened to Jean-Éric Vergne and Stoffel Vandoorne. So they're midfielders at the moment. And, okay, yeah, that's not an absolute write-off, but...
Yeah, but it's not what DS are expecting. Well, this is a multiple championship team.
When you hold it
up
to the light of what Maserati did with the same car last weekend, and Maserati are still rebuilding after a seismic change in their structure over the last off-season, it is worrying for DS Penske. So they've got to really pick up. I mean, they will, but... Like last season, they're just in a middle ground.
Well, it's not the drivers, is it? We know that is arguably the strongest driver lineup on the grid, or one of the strongest driver lineups on the grid, and yet, yeah, there's nothing they seem to be able to do with it at the minute.
No, and I think the shake-up that they've had in their team with some new hires, obviously Phil Charles is the key one there. I think it will get better, but what they have to do is just try and understand exactly how they how they can get into the duels. I mean, you know, strangely, they've had some really strong performances this season. You know, Jean-Eric Verne has got a pole position.
I think he was your pick to win this race, wasn't he? Pre-weekend.
I don't think that's on record, is it? I hope not. I fancied Jeff this weekend. Yeah. He's really good on new tracks.
Yeah.
Great qualifier. And he's somebody who can defend. So if he'd have done a Gunter or a Rowland, I think, you know, if he could have qualified and got something out of this package.
No, I agree.
You know, you're absolutely right. Yeah, the driver does take a little bit of culpability in it. It's part of the whole fundamental nature of the package. But if you don't do it, you've got to take collective responsibility and try and improve things. But yeah, it's a shame. I expected at least Verne, because he's had the better form over Stoffel Vandoorne. I was surprised they weren't able to do what Nissan and Maserati did last weekend.
More tales of woe as we work our way down the order. Lucas de Grassi and Nick de Vries had a coming together that ultimately took all of them out. This seemed to be something a few of the drivers were complaining about in the pre-race driver's briefing, that if there's a bit of a log jam, if you're the third driver in the queue, it's just impossible to know that things are backed up, and that seems to be what happened, and de Vries piled into the back. But neither of them were in the hunt for points, were they? It's a tough season back there.
Yeah, de Vries and de Grassi in the lower reaches of midfield was never going to come off particularly pleasantly, was it? There was always going to be some contact. Yeah, I think a lot of it's just frustration. You know, both of those guys just don't want to be in that position. They've had the glory days in the past. Their packages, they're both in a Mahindra, and they know that they've got lots of limitations, so that sometimes comes out with frustration. And I think when you're down in 14th, 15th, 16th position, there must be part of your mindset that just thinks, I'll just have a go.
Yeah.
And when you're on a track,
well, there is literally nothing to lose, right?
When you're on a track like Tokyo, there's a good percentage of that the outcome isn't going to come off particularly well. And Nick de Vries hit Lucas de Grassi. Prior to that, de Grassi had contact with Jake Hughes. I mean, that one, I think, was a genuine racing incident. Lucas seemed to just about have it done, made a bit of contact with Hughesy, and Jake went into the barrier. But yeah, I think last two races, for, you know, de Grassi's had a significant amount of contact, and I think a lot of that is probably frustration at where he is and not really seeing the light of how he can get out of it. But then on the other side of the garage, as we mentioned briefly, Nico Müller continues to put in truly heroic performances in that Apps Mahindra.
He's been a little star, hasn't he?
And he got seventh place, got into the duels again, and okay, you know, I think from what we saw from Mortara, he just like had the edge on the quartet of Mahindras last weekend, obviously. But Nico Müller doing great things again in that car. Imagine what he could do in a Porsche.
Maybe we'll find out. Obviously, the last time out, McLaren there celebrating the win. This time out, to say there was nothing to celebrate is almost under-egging it. Just really one of those ones to write off and move on.
Yeah, hands down, Neon McLaren's worst Ypres. I mean, going from absolute heroes in Sao Paulo to zeros in Tokyo is pretty depressing.
Did you say Bird's steering wheel came off?
That's what I was told. Yeah, they had a problem with the steering on that car early on in the race. And the feedback I got from the team was that it had to be pitted, because the wheel was actually loose and then coming off in stages. So obviously,
well, you can't drive with that, can you?
A fundamental safety issue. Yeah, you can't drive it on the column. Not round Tokyo. You might be able to do it temple off, but no, yeah, a bit of a worrying one. That obviously that will be investigated, put Sam out of contention. And as we mentioned with Jake Hughes, right down at he was midfield. He managed to start midfield, but got in the de Grassi zone and went straight into the barrier. 0 points for Neon McLaren, one to forget. They'll do an exhaustive debrief investigation, whatever you want to call it. I think they'll be pretty strong in Misano, though. Misano should suit that Nissan package a bit more. And they'll be back, but yeah, a write-off race really for those guys.
So there were two big announcements over this weekend. One was Nissan being the first manufacturer to commit to Gen 4. The second was the introduction of a new manufacturer, and that's the announcement that Lola and Yamaha will be coming in as a powertrain supplier for next season. I believe you caught up with Mark Preston, who's involved in the project, so let's hear from him.
So Mark Preston, Motorsport Director of Lola Cars. We're here in the Tokyo paddock. Big announcement yesterday with Yamaha. Lola, the legendary Lola name, and Yamaha, of course, who've got great history in Formula One and other strands of motorsport, coming together for a Formula E program next season. First of all, tell us about the formation of this and getting it together, because it's been a long process in the background. We know that you've been working really hard to get the package together. Just tell us about getting it to fruition and announcing yesterday.
Yeah, so it, actually in the background, as you say, we've been working on this for quite a while. We got together with Yamaha a couple of years ago and started to look at things. They visited a few of the races, and Lola came back to rebirth, then we obviously were started working with Till, and then started figuring out how we could all work together. And I think probably been about 18 months, I think, probably now or more actually, we've been working in the background. So everybody's a bit surprised that we suddenly popped up now with everything almost ready to go, and been working away feverishly in the background.
So you presided over back-to-back title wins for Techeeta and then DS Techeeta back in Gen 1 and Gen 2. You know what it takes to get a winning proposition up and running, but this is Gen 3. What do you think about the technical differences and the challenges now with this new car as we go into the Gen 3 Evo period?
Yeah, obviously back in those days we didn't have the front powertrain, so we didn't have to control all four wheels, but we've got some experienced people that have joined Lola over the last few months, and so it's going to be a lot about the software and making sure the whole package works together. But I think we've probably been working on the software for at least 6 months now, so I think we're setting ourselves up well, approaching it in the right ways. I think one thing at Techeeta was that we all kind of always thought we've got to be on a positive gradient, always going forward, always getting better, always learning, and we know it'll take a little while to get going, but we're trying to minimize the risks by watching and learning and sort of I suppose being a bit humble to make sure that we don't overestimate what we've done or underestimate how difficult the car will be to develop. But I think we've got a good test program, a solid test program, and a good amount of resources with Yamaha and Lola to get the job done, and hopefully be battling next year.
Professional motorsport, particularly Formula E, is all about timelines. It's very sort of concertina time frame to get things up and running for next season, which may start in December. It may be this calendar year that we're going into the next season. Tell us about where you're at. When are you getting the big bits of the car? When are you going to be testing? And then a little bit about the program heading into season 11.
Yeah, so in the background we've been making sure, having known that Formula E can start in December, we kind of planned for the worst, or not the worst, but you know, the earliest that it could happen, and therefore work back from there. The chassis test car actually arrived yesterday at the factory in Silverstone, so that's exciting. That'll be taken out of the bubble wrap, and all the bits started to be put together. Many of the parts are getting ready and being built up for dyno testing, so they'll do unit testing first, so gearbox and MGU will be tested separately first, and then the whole package put together, run on dynos, and then move towards a shakedown, hopefully in a month or two, and then really set up the test program there, from there all the way to the combined test in looks like early November.
Obviously you're going to partner with an existing team. Any sort of indication of when that's going to be announced and when we can look forward to getting those additional plans formed from your point of view?
I thought you'd have enough exciting news this weekend with this big launch. Well, we only do one big announcement every weekend, so hopefully in the coming weeks we'll be announcing the next steps, and it'll be you'll see the good progress towards being competitive next season.
And Till's not here. Till Bechtolsheimer, who's the owner of Lola Cars, it's less than a couple of years since he acquired the great name. Give us a bit of an appraisal as to his plans just generally for Lola and getting it back into competition.
Yeah, one of the great bits about the rebirth of Lola is that his vision to have kind of three pillars of I suppose, differentiation from what was traditionally Lola's strengths of chassis and aerodynamics, or what it's known for historically. So the first pillar is electrification, and obviously this entry into Formula E sets us on the path to being at the pinnacle, I would say, of electrified racing. The second pillar is hydrogen, and we see that there's a lot of crossover between the electrified four-wheel drive powertrains and software, which is becoming way bigger element of motor racing from when Lola was last racing. So we're looking at those core elements that can be taken across from electrification, hydrogen, which obviously would look at prototypes and those kind of cars, and just recently, obviously, World Motorsport Council announced more to do with the hydrogen element and the push that they're doing there from the FIA side. So we're joining, you know, those discussions. And then the final element to it is sustainable fuels and materials, which is obviously really interesting to look at the sustainability of not only the Formula E projects, but anything we can do in sports cars and other elements. So they're the three pillars, and that sets us up with a great strategy for the future, and hopefully differentiates it, Lola, from our competitors.
Well, I don't think you've ever mentioned it on this pod before, a bit like me having previously worked at Formula E, but I believe you have some Lola connections, Sam. So what do you make of this? It's a great move, Formula E, and the images, the renders they sent out of that car, I mean, I don't think that it's going to look like that, but it's striking. It's good.
I mean, a feel-good story, isn't it, for everybody? I think Formula E needed a new manufacturer. I don't think anyone who didn't know about what was going on in the background foresaw Lola and Yamaha coming in. I mean, taking each individual component there, Lola cars reanimated from administration in 2012, bought by Till Bechtolsheimer, who is a businessman, US-based British businessman, who has passion for motorsport, races in IMSA, and he's got big plans to reinvigorate Lola, bring it back in an innovative way, and back on the racing stage, which is fantastic to see, having worked for the company for 10 years myself. Yamaha, equally a name that is associated with two-wheel racing, of course, but does have some heritage in four-wheel racing, particularly in the 80s and the 90s, that famous 97 season with Damon Hill.
Almost won a Grand Prix.
In the Arrows Hungaro ring, yeah. You can still see that, kicking up that, getting Villa to kick up that dust as he went past and fainted across. Yeah, I talked to some of the Yamaha guys at the weekend, as well as Mark Preston, and again, they're very ambitious. The presumption, it's not absolutely confirmed, but they were spending a lot of time at the apt pit.
It wasn't subtle.
It wasn't very subtle. So, yeah, they're going to be racing with apt. It's likely to be announced soon.
Yeah, so I think it's probably expected for the next race. So, talking of which, we're off to another new track for Formula E. Again, one more synonymous with two-wheel racing, Misano. Lovely part of the world on the Adriatic there, but not necessarily a track I ever thought Formula E would be racing at.
No, I mean, this is Fellini country. Federico Fellini was Rimini, wasn't he? Yeah. And they did all those great films there. But I wouldn't call this a blockbuster event for Formula E at Misano. This is, we presume that this is going to be a stopgap to something.
A two-off.
Yeah, a double header there. Although, you know, speaking to Jeff Dodds, as we did last week, well, that seems about 3 months ago, doesn't it? It was last
really
Wednesday.
Does, yeah.
But speaking to Jeff Dodds, they've embraced Formula E in terms of the promotion they're doing and getting this event on. I think it might surprise some people in terms of what they're able to do in the paddock and the look of the event. Getting a crowd there is going to be a challenge.
Yeah.
In April. The circuit will reserve judgment on the track, but I struggle to just get in my mind how Formula E is going to look there. I think it's so close this year, it's going to naturally bring great elements of racing. Lots of overtakes, and you know, it's likely to be a high energy race, so we're going to get probably some aspects of the peloton effect of racing. Who knows? Let's not malign it too much at the minute, but I think in terms of where Formula E goes in Italy, I presume that they are looking, well, I know that they're looking at potential other, more urban areas to go racing for Formula E in the future. But yeah, let's give Misano a chance and see where it's a double header. You know, there's 58 points on offer, so it is crucial for the championship as it goes into this midway phase of its season.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm really looking forward to, I won't be at that one, sadly, but enjoy being out there. Hopefully the weather's nice. I'm sure the food will be fantastic. Thank you all for listening. Remember to check the-race.com for all the latest Formula E news, and remember to check out our other podcasts, including our brand new one, Colossally That's History, where Matt Bishop and Richard Williams tell some fantastic stories from the history of motorsport past. So if you veer down memory lane like we almost did with the Hungary 97 there, this is a podcast you're sure to love. So check that out. Thank you. Goodbye.
The Athletic.